We've not only got split arguments, but we've got a cross appeal in this case too, so we'll try to keep it all straight. Mr. Dinger, you represent Teva. And you're going to go forward for 9 minutes.
I'm going for 9 minutes. And Ms. Mazzocchi, who is arguing after me for Lupin, is going to stick a note in front of me with about 30 seconds left, so at my request. So
well, we are going to run the clock separately.
Oh,
so you'll
terrific.
Have your nine
okay.
minutes. You'll know when your time is up. Okay.
Very good.
All right. Proceed, please.
Good morning. The district court in this case made findings that frankly led to the conclusion that the claims in suit were obvious. The court stumbled in its final analysis because it made a legal error. It defined what constitutes a reasonable...
So do you want us to just simply accept all of the lower court's findings?
No, Your Honor. I mean, and I'll identify some places, but for the most part, I'm going to be arguing for the legal error. We argue in our brief that several of the findings, for example, that concerns about cross-resistance would, in fact, discourage a person from combining the drugs in question. We think that's clearly erroneous. We think the finding that the prior art, there was no publication in the prior art that suggested that combining drugs that worked on different bases was also clearly erroneous. And we've argued that in our brief. But I'd like to focus, if I may, on what we think is a fundamental legal error that essentially affected all of the district court's rulings on obviousness. The district court found that by March 1995, combination therapy was generally thought to offer better treatment opportunities. The court found that abacavir was a ripe candidate for researching new combination therapies for many reasons that are set forth at page 32 and 33 and 53 of the brief. The court found that both 3TC and abacavir were potent, less toxic than AZT, and synergistic with other NRTIs. The court found that despite the success of the AZT combination, AZT-3TC combination, many patients could not or would not take AZT because of its side effects. The district court stopped short, though, of concluding that the combination of abacavir and 3TC to treat HIV infection was obvious because, in the district court's view, skilled artisans would not reasonably expect the abacavir-3TC combination to be successful. The court concluded that skilled artisans would not expect that combination would sustain effectiveness before resistance took over.
So I guess we've got a mixture of law and fact here, whatever. I just want to call out your argument and see at bottom on the legal question of where you say there was legal error. Can you point us to what sentences or what tests the district court used that you allege?
Sure, I'll give you an example. Page 50, A55, the court says, it is clear that the art of HIV treatment was littered with failures.
Can you tell me, I'm looking at the page, can you tell, is the last paragraph, middle of the last paragraph, is that what you're reading from?
Let me actually get to it, Your Honor.
It is clear that the art of HIV treatment
it is clear,
litters
yeah.
with failures. Okay.
That the art of HIV treatment was littered with failures as of March 30th, 1994. Only a single combination, AZT-3TC, had shown any significant sustained effectiveness against the virus. And then again on page 70 of the...
that seems to me a question of... I mean, that's just a fact. I mean, he's saying only a single combination had shown any sustained effectiveness. That's a statement of fact.
That's the only success, Your Honor. The court said that sustaining clinical effectiveness in that sense was the only success. And another point, a finding of obviousness.
If you look at this first statement in context,
right.
what the trial court is saying is, was there a failure of others? All right, so that's a factual finding that relates to whether there was any failure of others. So what is legal error about that statement?
Because the district court consistently, through the opinion, defined success solely with reference. The only success that the district court identified was AZT-3TC, and the only reason that was successful was that it was able to sustain clinical effectiveness beyond for a period longer than other therapies had been able to do. HIV was slower to develop resistance to the AZT3TC combination than the virus was
I'm really unclear. Let me tell you what I thought your argument was, and then you can tell me where I'm off, because you seem to be saying different things here. I thought that your argument was, and leaving aside that I can understand some confusion here, because with regard to claim construction, you're arguing synergy.
Yes.
So let's leave that aside. But with respect to obviousness, I understood your argument to be the standard is whether something would lead to a reasonable expectation of success, and that the district court defined success at too high a level, because what he required was sustained therapeutic effects, sustained clinical efficiency, and there's nothing in the claims that requires that. Because I didn't quite glean that from what you were telling us this morning. Maybe
I spoke badly, because that is precisely my argument. The error of law that the district court made was defining the success that a person of skill in the art must reasonably expect not to be what the patent claimed, but something else.
Something more.
Something more. As Chief Judge Prost said in the Allergan versus Sandoz case, the person of ordinary skill need only have a reasonable expectation of success of developing the claimed invention.
Now, the difficulty, though, in your argument is the district court's opinion is amazingly thorough. And I think I see your point that some of the fact-finding there cuts your way. I mean, he was very measured, very balanced, clearly considered every piece of evidence, and took it all very seriously. So it's really hard to pinpoint, assuming we're understanding the same legal argument from your perspective, it really is hard to pinpoint where the district court really applied the wrong standard. His opinion is so thorough and so fulsome that he's saying a lot of things, and I really had a hard time identifying precisely where that legal error occurred, frankly, I'll tell you.
The findings of the district court support the inference that a person of skill in the art would expect the combinations of this patent to treat HIV infection, at least for a time. There really wasn't any significant dispute about that. The reason the district court did not draw the inference that a skilled artisan would expect the combination of drugs to do what they did individually was that, he said, they would be worried about cross-resistance. And cross-resistance matters because it would lead, in the view of the district court, to an expectation that resistance would come sooner than it would with the AZT-3TC combination. The court couldn't have been clearer.
Are you disputing his fact-finding when he says it's clear that the art of HIV treatment was littered with failures as of March of 95? Are you saying that he is evaluating failures as it's only a success if it would work longer term, that in fact the facts don't support that these things were failures, they support the fact that they don't have success over time?
Yes.
Is that your point?
That is exactly my point. And that is a good indication of where the district court's reasoning led him to legal error and not factual. You can accept the fact that AZT-3TC appeared at the relevant time to have sustained efficacy longer than the previous ones, but monotherapies were still being used.
Combinations. And that's actually important, because one of the things that the trial court found is that some two drug combinations worked for a while and others didn't seem to work very well at all, and certainly didn't work better than certain monotherapies. So, I mean, what the trial court did was find that this whole two drug combination therapy was in a state of flux. Sometimes it was good, sometimes it wasn't good. Made those factual findings.
Your Honor, I think this is another place where I think the district court made a clear error of fact. In fact, all of the prior art discussion of combinations of NRTIs, the drug category in which these drugs came from, said that they were all synergistic or additive to synergistic. The court said that there was one combination that was antagonistic In other words, they combined and made things worse. But the only evidence of that was from the lab notebooks of one of the inventors, which is not prior art. The prior art consistently taught that these combinations would generally be better, be more effective than monotherapies. Most of the combinations that were reported in the prior art showed that they delayed resistance longer than monotherapies, not as long as AZT3TC, but sustained it. And this was a time when physicians were prescribing drugs to hold off resistance, to hold off AIDS, and drugs that did that even for a time, even for a period of months, were considered effective and important.
You are in your time, so why don't we hear from Ms. Oshii?
Good morning, Deanne Mazzocchi on behalf of the Lupin defendants. I'm going to try to not repeat what Teva said because we obviously have some of the same concerns about the legal analysis that the district court performed in terms of making it too high of a standard on expectations of success and criteria that could be identified as problems that needed to be solved. But when in the context of the triple combination, here again, the district court's fact findings, many of them we think actually support the ultimate conclusion of non-obviousness.
Right, and he said that.
Right, exactly. And the findings that he offered, that AZT3TC was the best combination, that ABC was ripe for use in combination therapy, it was known to be an up-and-coming anti-HIV drug that had some better side effects, better improved bioavailability, those facts are reasons to combine them into the triple combination.
So where did he go astray?
I think he went astray in the sense that he said, for example, well, there were instances where you had a triple NRTI combination, AZT3TC and DDI, which was an already FDA-approved drug. He said, well, the clinical results weren't in on that yet, so how can that inspire imitation? Well, that's not really the standard in terms of teaching suggestion motivation or having a reason to combine. The district court simultaneously made fact findings that abacavir was a recognized improvement over DDI. Smaller pill burden, it had synergy with AZT, it was more potent, it had fewer side effects. So the clinical trial didn't have to have results in to be a guarantee of success in order for the person of ordinary skill in the art to be motivated to use ABC within that combination.
But he credited Dr. Ho's testimony that one of skill in the art wouldn't be motivated to make the combination because they wouldn't believe that that combination could possibly outperform AZT3TC, so they wouldn't be motivated to do it.
And that's the error of law, because when it comes to the actual claims that are asserted here, the triple combination claims, and even the double combination claims, don't provide any comparative efficacy parameters. If the claims had said a method for treating whereby this triple combination it achieves efficacy superior to AZT3TC.
What about toxicity? Maybe they wouldn't be doing it on efficacy, but wouldn't they be concerned about toxicity, dumping all these drugs onto an immune-suppressed patient?
No,
isn't that what the record shows?
No, in fact, quite the opposite. The record showed that you had a combination of AZT3TC and DDI, and the judge Andrews found that abacavir was going to be a less toxic NRTI.
Right, but because of the cross resistance, he said there would be no motivation to combine it.
For the ABC3TC, but when it comes to abacavir, it actually includes the same mutation that resensitizes the combination back to AZT. So that does
not. And
you're
saying that he made a factual error.
No, he made that finding. It was not disputed below that DDI and abacavir produce similar cross-mutation patterns, and that one of the mutations, not only the M184, but the L75 V, that both of those mutations that ABC produced resensitized back
right,
to
but
ABC.
But the cross-resistance with the 3TC was an issue that he was concerned about.
For the double combination. But for the triple combination, if you're put, when you're putting AZT back in it, then it works. And again, it gets back to, first of all, not only what is claimed, because the 191 patent doesn't claim a, you know, a combination that avoids cross-resistance or that comparatively avoids cross-resistance. Cross-resistance is not a problem that the 191 patent purports to solve. And that's a problem because under Merck v. Teva and this court's, I believe it was the Alcon v. Abbatec, which actually this entire panel was on, the fact that you might have some generalized safety concerns that are not resolved by the patent specification, that's not a valid problem that you can be focusing on. Same thing with the Merck v. Teva alendronate case.
No, but that all goes very much to whether one of skill in the art would be motivated to make that combination.
But the person of ordinary skill, you can't have, what you're basically saying is that because of this problem, the person of ordinary skill in the art would be skeptical that the combination would work. And in Merck v. Teva, this court specifically said, no, 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 you can't do that. If the patent itself doesn't try to solve the problem, you can't say that that represents skepticism. Because Merck tried to make the same argument in Merck v. Teva. They said that there were...
The trial court didn't make a skepticism finding. The trial court specifically found against the patent holder on the skepticism issue. So, I mean, you're mixing apples and oranges here. What the trial court was saying is that there's got to be some motivation to put these things together. And you rely on very limited things. You rely on the abstracts, two little abstracts, which is kind of funny about whether you can rely on abstracts or not.
But aren't all abstracts little?
Yes. So, but two abstracts and the larger application, which is very generalized and has a huge number of combinations. So that's what the trial court was trying to say, is there enough in there to motivate someone to take a particular combination and put them together? Skepticism was not the issue. He found in your favor on skepticism.
No, but I think that this idea that there's somehow a problem out there that could discourage the motivation to do the combination. We have the motivation to do the combination because the back here is a new up-and-coming NRTI. He said that doctors would be willing to try anything as long as there wasn't a reason against it. And he also found that this was a more potent drug that solved some of the problems with the existing NRTIs that were, in fact, already used in a triple combination, both DDI as well as carbavir in the larder application. We also have the question of, even if in the abstract you wanted to create a triple combination, AZT-3TC is the best one to start with, and then if you want to add in a third because you want to hit hard, hit early, and he recognized that principle, then what drug are you going to use? You're going to use one of the very few drugs that is actually in human clinical trials that's being touted, which was abacavir, because that's the one drug that was out there that in that triple combination...
You didn't say the one drug. There were lots of drugs out there. Lots of drugs, and that was his point.
Not recommended.
And he's saying, among those lots of drugs, am I going to pick the one that has the cross resistance problem?
But if you want, but that's the problem, is that if you want to start talking about, I want to rule out something based on cross resistance, all the other drugs in the other classes, they had equal, if not worse, issues with cross resistance. None of them had been shown to work in combination to avoid cross resistance. That was true with nevirapine, that was true with loveride, that was true with...
I don't understand how that helps you. The fact that people tried things that might not have been viewed at the outset as potentially being successful doesn't mean they would have tried this thing.
No, but my point is that you can't, if you want to say, here's all these other drugs that I'm going to put on the table, and then but I want to consider cross resistance as my preeminent thing, even though cross resistance and avoiding cross resistance is not something that's claimed. And not something that you need to achieve in order to have reasonable expectation of success to achieve what is claimed, that's still not a reason to say, I won't pursue it. The Merck v. Biocraft case, there were 1,200 possible combinations. And the particular one that was selected out of it was still viewed as being being obvious.
Well, so but in your case, I mean, abacavir wasn't even mentioned in Larder. I mean, you have to then jump another step and say, well, they would have picked Cabavir, is that how you pronounce it?
Yes. So,
out of Larder, and then you would have found an analog that they would have taken another step. So, I mean, you're really taking us far down the road.
No, I disagree with that, because the Larder patent said, I hereby include this category of certain types of NRTI categories. To specifically exemplify one of those, he identified carbavir. It was undisputed below that abacavir and carbavir metabolize to produce the identical compound that actually does the therapeutic work in vivo. Abacavir, the district court found, was specifically designed to avoid toxicity problems that were associated with carbavir. So it's natural for the person of ordinary skill in the art to say, if I see this triple combination that's got carbavir, the obvious choice to improve upon it is to use abacavir, because abacavir was specifically designed to resolve known problems with carbavir.
I think your time's up. One quick question. Does this actually matter to your client? Your client was found not to infringe. Right? Not to infringe. So you decided to cross appeal in a blue brief on obviousness. I get it. There's lots of tactical reasons you may decide to do that. But your client won.
I understand that. But Veeve is also asserting the same patent against my client in another...
In the district court. But that's the same infringement. If we affirmed on non-infringement, that case would be over there too. Right? Your client wins either way if you prevail on the infringement.
Is that true? Is there another... You mentioned another case.
It's the same identical
claim. The same claims.
Yes. Thank you.
Mr. Quinn. Mr. Oakland, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Chief Judge Prost, and may it please the Court. Just one clarification. The case that's pending in the district court involves the assertion of additional claims. So it's not, it wouldn't be, it doesn't involve just the claims that were issued in this case.
But would the infringement finding, the non-infringement finding here, if we upheld it, would that control in that case?
Not with respect to all of the claims that have been asserted in that case. That's my understanding, Judge O'Malley. Turning back to the issue of obviousness, and then I do want to come to the issue of infringement. The district court's finding of non-obviousness after a trial involving some 10 experts is well-grounded in the facts. Dr. Berry and Ms. St. Clair's discovery of the claimed pharmaceutical combinations was the product of their unique insight from their experience in this field for over a decade.
Just to back up, when you say there are other claims asserted, you mean from a whole different unrelated patent,
No,
right?
there no, Judge Moore, there are
from
other
claims. From the same
claims.
Patent?
The derivative claims?
No, some of them may be derivative claims, but there are claims that are asserted, independent claims that are asserted in the action that's pending in the district court that are not the same as all of the claims that are asserted in this case. And I believe some of them are also independent claims that did not go to trial in this case.
What's the status of that case?
Well, there are claims that involve physiologically functional derivatives, and the status of that case is, I think it's relatively early in that case.
When does this patent expire?
This patent expires in March of 2016. And Judge O'Malley, some of the claims asserted in that case do involve physiologically functional derivatives. Those are more than just salt claims. Physiological functional derivatives contain things that are more than salts. They include esters, ethers, salts of esters, and indeed they give rise to things, not to jump ahead to non-infringe or to the issue of infringement, but they give rise to things that create active ingredients different than the active ingredient of abacavir. So it's not the case that physiological functional derivatives all necessarily give you abacavir. Some of them give you other metabolites of abacavir and don't go through the step of becoming abacavir. And that is why the district court fundamentally erred on the issue of infringement here. There are three separate reasons that the district court erred in infringement. One is the interpretation of the claims. Under this court's teaching in Merck versus Teva, actually it's a different Merck versus Teva case than my colleague was discussing. Second is that regardless of how the claims are actually construed, there's no factual dispute that the method claims would actually be infringed. And that's because a patient is in fact treated with abacavir-free base. Because abacavir sulfate immediately dissolves into abacavir, and the patient is in fact therefore treated with abacavir-free base. That's not disputed. Their expert, Lupin's expert, Dr. Arnold, at Appendix 441, testified that the Lupin's product, quote, provides abacavir. That is the active ingredient. Otherwise, the product won't work, end quote. And indeed, if you look at the label on Lupin's product at A5782, it says, quote, in vivo, abacavir sulfate disassociates to its free base abacavir. And for that reason, the dosages on the labels themselves are in terms of abacavir as opposed to abacavir sulfate. And in these 5812, the label refers to abacavir as being the active ingredient. And so what you have is a situation where the all of the elements for method claims 39 and 39 are literally met, even if the abacavir chemical formula term were construed as just encompassing abacavir free base and not also encompassing abacavir sulfate. And the reason for that is because abacavir sulfate is... the patients are treated with abacavir sulfate because it disassociates into it. The patient is treated with AZT, and the patient is treated with 3TC. And if you look at the elements for claims 30 and 39, that's all that they require. The district court didn't actually really grapple with this particular issue of non-infringement. I mean, the district court's
opinion. I'd like to move to obviousness.
I'd be happy to, Judge Moore.
AZT and 3TC was the gold standard. I don't remember where, but somewhere in the opinion that was what he found, right?
I don't know if he used those words, but I'm sure those words were used at trial, Judge Moore. And indeed, it was considered...
Page 50 of his opinion, A55 of the record, actually. It says, AZT 3TC was known as the gold standard of HIV treatment in March of 1995. So I think I'll treat that as a fact finding.
Sure.
So if that's the gold standard that everyone's using, yet... it's still wearing off, and it's not, I mean, certainly not solving all the problems, and doctors are still out there repeatedly and often trying other combinations to see if they can get a little more out of the effectiveness. Why wouldn't, can I call it ABC? Is that?
Sure. Abacavir is sometimes referred to as ABC.
Okay, well, yes, all the acronyms are tough, but so are the words for me. But abacavir. So why wouldn't it have been obvious since abacavir had been one of the other chemicals that have been used in monotherapy to just sort of, I mean, it seemed like a bit of a free-for-all from a medical standpoint in terms of, okay, here are a bunch of things. As monotherapies, they're just a little effective but not good for this, it's a little effective but not good, and then they're mushing things together. I mean, it seemed like a Wild West sort of approach to combining things. Why would it not have been obvious to add abacavir to what is the gold standard?
Oh, well, Judge Moore, first, if you're looking at this through the analysis of an obvious to try analysis, you're dealing with a world where there were hundreds, if not thousands, of possible combinations that a person of ordinary skill in the art would potentially be exploring. And this court has repeatedly suggested that when you're in the medical arts and in the chemical arts, the obvious to try analysis typically doesn't fit because you can't predict how things are going to behave. And that's exactly what the case was, that yes, it's true, different combinations were being tried.
But there are only 28 drugs in clinical trials, and abacavir was one of them. So while theoretically there might be thousands, truthfully we're talking about a universe of 28 at this point in time.
No, we're not, Judge Moore. Emphatically, we are not. And in fact, if you look at what the defendant's own experts testified about, Dr. Arnold and Dr. Parniak both were asked, because they were working in this field at the time, what do you do? What were you doing then? And what they were doing, they were working with a number of different types of compounds, NNRTIs, protease inhibitors, and Dr. Parniak was specifically asked and specifically testified he was working with drugs that not only were not in clinical trials, they hadn't even been tried in animal studies. The idea that a person of ordinary skill in the art
would...
Well,
that's troubling for a whole different set of reasons. Well, I don't think that necessarily gets you to the lack of motivation to combine.
What it does, Judge Moore, is it gets you that you're not in a universe of 28 drugs. And you're not in a universe where the spotlight should be appropriately shined on abacavir. The only reason to focus on abacavir today is through the rubric of hindsight. I mean, at that time... In March of 1995, there were no clinical results with respect to abacavir. It's true that
it was identified. There were only 28 clinical trials that were going on at that time, which is actually a lot, so I shouldn't say only. But there are 28 clinical trials that are going on, and that is one of the 28 of the millions of possible drugs. Obviously, somebody thought that one had enough potential at that time. I mean, clinical trials are not cheap. A lot of oversight? I mean, somebody thought that was one of the most promising possibilities.
Well, Judge Moore, the inventors had identified abacavir as being a promising possibility. The quote that the defendants rely on comes from an abstract that Ms. St. Clair herself was one of the authors of. I mean, yes, the inventors in this case, who also, Ms. St. Clair was involved in identifying the activity specifically of AZT, specifically the activity of abacavir, and early studies with 3TC itself, and that was the insight that she was able to bring to bear here. Yes, she had identified abacavir as being something for further study. And the reason that the district court found that is because the district court was rejecting the argument that someone would completely exclude abacavir, that you wouldn't consider abacavir at all, and was saying no, it was something that you would consider trying, like you would consider trying a lot of other things. But the point is, the district court rejected the notion that this is a world that was limited to 28 drugs that were in clinical trials. And even if you're talking about 28, you're talking about different dosages, different formulations, different delivery. I mean, so you're not talking about a narrow universe. But then on top of that...
But I didn't think that's what we were really disputing vis-a-vis these particular claims, was the dosage levels made it non-obvious or the formulation. I thought it was the combination of these three drugs. It was really the heart of what we're trying to figure out on
that. Oh, no, my point, Judge Moore, is that the fact that you have certain drugs that are out there in clinical trials doesn't mean that you're in a universe of obvious to try, because there are lots of different trials that would then have to follow, even if you were starting with those 28. But on top of that, you have specific testimony that the district court credited from Dr. Ho, this is at A1443 to 1444, on why a person of ordinary skill in the art wouldn't have been motivated to take the AZT-3TC combination and add to abacavir to it. And he said, quote, if you're going to build on AZT and 3TC at that time, certainly it's more logical to use the PIs, the protease inhibitors, and the NNRTIs, because they were further along with the clinical data and showing a great deal of potency in patients. And then on top of that, Dr. Ho also testified about concerns with toxicity with triple NRTI combinations at A1440.
But the court found that the toxicity wouldn't be as high with ABC as it was with carbonite. I'm not going to say it right, because I know that's not whatever.
Carbonate.
Yeah, okay.
Well, that
but he made an express finding that toxicity wouldn't be as much of a concern with the...
With respect to that one in particular, and Dr. Ho did talk about that there was a risk of synergistic toxicity between AZT and abacavir, and part that risk came out of concerns over carbavir. But separate apart from that, Dr. Ho testified at A1440, quote, there was a lot of concern that we might be doing too much chain termination for normal DNA, and by and large, people avoided the combination of a triple NRTI in part for that reason. And in fact,
right,
there was
so only between two triple NRTIs, abacavir might have been a little bit better. But as between triple NRTIs and other combinations, that's what the district court was focusing on, right?
Right. In other words, so you have two drugs here. One is a double combination of abacavir and 3TC. That runs headlong into concerns about cross resistance. It was well known that both abacavir and 3TC selected for, that is, resulted in the same primary mutation, the M184V mutation. And it was also well known that the M184V mutation basically rendered 3TC almost immediately ineffective. And so the idea that you would start with 3TC or start with abacavir and think to put the two of them together is entirely built out of hindsight. And then with respect to whether you would take AZT and 3TC and then add to it abacavir, there was only one example in the prior art, two abstracts, one of which came from the inventors, of any triple NRTI combination. That was the one involving DDI. It wasn't as though there was like some particular reason. The art didn't say you should explore triple NRTI combinations for this reason, and there is a reason to then go back in and take DDI out and put abacavir in. That's constructed completely out of hindsight. And in fact, what you have is the opposite, and this is the testimony from Dr. Ho, that in general, there would be a desire to avoid triple NRTI combinations, because what that does is it stops the normal functioning of DNA. And instead, what a person of ordinary skill in the art would have been motivated to do is exactly what Dr. Ho did, which is to look at other classes of compounds. Because the NRTIs are functional, look at one step in how HIV replicates within the human body. There are a lot of other different steps. And what made sense is to take a backbone and then add other things to it. And that's exactly what Dr. Ho successfully pursued separately in a different direction.
Now, you wanted to reserve some of your time for rebuttal on the cross appeal. That's up to you.
I did. I believe the clock started at 18, and so I think... But I'm happy if the court has...
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. I apologize.
If the court has no further questions on the with respect to obviousness or any of the other issues that were raised in the appeal, I'm happy to rest and reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal that would only be on the issue of infringement. But if there are other questions on the issue of obviousness or anything else, I'd be happy to address those.
We're good.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Please, the court. I'm just going to make a couple of quick points because I don't have much time. First of all, abacavir is not just another drug. If you look at the district court's opinion at pages 31 and 33 of the appendix, it identifies all of the reasons why abacavir was not just another drug but was at the top of the list.
But there is this important point about the difference between the three NRTIs and the two NRTIs. I mean, the toxicity is, this isn't just a minor level of toxicity. We're talking about, you know, making people severely ill and anemic and gastrointestinal problems and everything else, right?
That cuts, I suggest, the other way, Your Honor, because one of the principal motivations, the judge found that no one in their right mind would break up the combination of AZT, 3TC, and substitute abacavir for the AZT. That's simply wrong. I mean, there was a clear motivation. The biggest problem with AZT, 3TC is that there was a substantial subpopulation of patients who could not take it or would not take it.
Right, but you made specific findings of fact and credibility determinations on that issue. I mean, you've got a huge uphill climb.
I don't think there was any dispute that was a problem, that toxicity was a problem with the AZT 3TC combination.
But the
prior art was also quite clear that abacavir was not nearly as toxic as AZT.
But the problem is if you take out the AZT and you just combine it with 3TC, that's when you have the cross resistance and other toxicity issues.
Cross resistance is not a toxicity issue, Your Honor. Cross resistance is an issue that deals with how long the judge will suppress HIV reproduction before resistant strains of HIV emerge that are unaffected by the drug. The cross-resistance problem is that, as the district judge thought of it, was that a person of skill in the art would be concerned that the abacavir 3TC combination would not suppress viral reproduction for as long a period of time as the AZT 3TC combination. There is no doubt that it would be less toxic. So, I'm in tomorrow.
Thank you.
Let me address just a couple of quick things on obviousness, and then I'll jump into the non-infringement.
Well, could you first say, was he correct? I asked you if the district court litigation as to your client would be entirely resolved if we were affirming on non-infringement here. Is he correct that it's not the case that it would be?
I don't know whether they're going to continue to assert all the claims at trial that they did in this case. Presumably, if they decide to assert more claims, even if they're invalidated, even if we find non-infringement here, that's still going to create a separate set of claims.
No, are there claims asserted in the other litigation to which the non-infringement decision here would not apply?
I believe there are.
Okay. And how could there be a second lawsuit without an argument that the cause of action was split?
I mean, I'm not, I'm not prepared today to talk about issues of potential claim preclusion or collateral estoppel, but I do know that one of the reasons why we chose to file this cross-appeal on the invalidity issues is because we want to ensure that we are not prejudiced in the follow-on litigation. I mean, again, there's an IPR pending against this patent. Obviously, if that is resolved to invalidate the patent, that's going to impact the other litigation too. Okay. But we're not...
Go ahead, get under your rebuttal.
Sure. Now, I did want to say that for Dr. Ho, Dr. Ho's testimony about why he thought you would want to use as a third drug the protease inhibitors, he specifically said that he was basing that on his own personal experience within his lab, where he had access to all kinds of non-public data regarding the protease inhibitors. And he conceded, and we put the cites in our brief, that that was not disclosed until 1996. So that teaching about the protease inhibitors cannot serve as a valid motivation teaching when we're looking at the relevant March 1995 time period here. Further, Dr. Ho also admitted, and this is at A1513, contrary to counsel's representation, he acknowledged that doctors had been prescribing triple NRTI combinations.
You mean the DDI?
No, not separate and apart from the DDI combination in the clinical trials. They had combined AZT, DDC, and DDI. So doctors had, in fact, done triple NRTI combinations, notwithstanding all of these existing cross-resistant concerns and what have you. And I would also like to note that the abstract, you know, small though it may be, it did actually say that the AZT-3TC-DDI combination, when it was tested in vitro, was actually one of the most potent combinations, particularly when given to patients early. So then what did they do? They then went into clinical trials and, you know, started giving it to children who were early on in the disease. So I think that the person of ordinary skill in the art can actually learn quite a lot from those two abstracts about why this is happening. You've got the AZT-3TC combination. You see what was done with the FDA-approved drug on the market, DDI, how they added it to the combination. So you know that abacavir is also synergistic with AZT, that in that it's got some properties that are better than DDI. That's a reason to include it in the combination.
But from that, you'd have to actually change two drugs from what was described in the abstract, correct?
No, just one. You would take the DDI, which was already on the market, and because abacavir was known to have attributes that were better than DDI, that would be the one that you would substitute. You would preserve the very successful AZT-3TC combination and then say, all right, but DDI, it has some known drawbacks.
But the district court made fact findings about cross resistance, and whether I agree with you or not, I have got to go give those clear error deference. I mean, maybe you're right. Maybe, you know, my juvenile understanding of the complexity of this technology, DDI and ABC, aren't that different from each other in lots of relevant respects. However, the district court said cross resistance was a problem. People were concerned about it. Those were his fact findings. How can I just disregard them because there happened to be a single or two single abstracts that proposed a three-drug combination like that?
Well, there was also physicians who had done the three-drug combination. They'd actually prescribed it.
Yes, but he made a fact-finding that people skilled in the art were worried about cross-resistance, and that's why they wouldn't do this. And yes, there is some limited evidence of some people doing it, but it's a fact-finding.
But even if they were...
How do I say it's clearly erroneous?
Because it's not teaching away. It's the fact that there might be some cross-resistance doesn't automatically mean that the triple drug combination is not going to achieve what is actually claimed, which is reducing the amount of HIV in the bloodstream. That's the key distinction.
He didn't say it was teaching away. What he said is you have the burden of proving that there is a motivation that exists in the prior art. It's not just a simple question of whether or not people were willing to take crapshoots. You have to actually say, was there a motivation that you can point to in the prior art that would make this obvious and that would provide a motivation to combine? And the trial court found that there was.
No, I disagree. The trial court found that there were reasons to include ABC in a combination. When he started focusing on cross-resistance, what he's basically doing is he's putting himself in the mindset of the inventors and saying, well, what were the inventors interested in? They were interested in cross-resistance, so I'm going to impute that to the person of ordinary skill in the art.
No, he said the question is not whether there is any motivation to put any particular drug into a combination generally, but is there a motivation to put this drug in this combination?
I understand that. And the problem is that when it comes to cross-resistance, that should not be a discouraging factor that can counter motivation, because the 191 patent itself doesn't solve the cross-resistance problem. If you want to basically say that cross-resistance is the end-all be-all that's going to allow a person of ordinary skill in the art to credibly believe that this combination is going to work, then the 191 patent claims themselves have to fall as non-enabled because they don't express a credible utility. I mean, that's the fundamental problem. The 191 patent doesn't solve the problem, and this court's precedent that we've cited is clear that you can't argue against a motivation based on a problem that the patent itself doesn't pretend to solve over the prior art. If I may, let me turn briefly to the non-infringement issues. First, I did want... Oh, I'm sorry. And there actually was testimony in the record. I will find it, where Dr. Blick actually testified that he prescribed drugs even though they were cross-resistant, and that cross-resistance would not factor into his prescribing decisions. Now, when it comes to the cross-appeal on claim construction, the district court specifically stated, and this is at A21, that our expert, Dr. Arnold, persuasively explained how the salt form is chemically distinct from the pure or free-base form of the Bacavir, that the court cannot find that persons skilled in the art would have understood the pure or free-base form of a Bacavir to be the same thing as or to encompass the salt form. Those are findings of fact, and they're due deference here. On the literal infringement question, we dispute plaintiff's characterization. That
are they findings of fact relating to claim construction? Is that your view on this?
I think that he made a finding of fact that the person of ordinary skill in the art would not view the 1S methanol chemical language as encompassing salts. And that's exactly what takes this case out of the realm of Merck v. Teva. It takes it out of the realm of the Stevens case that plaintiffs cited in their reply brief. He found the person of ordinary skill in the art would not view the chemical nomenclature in the claims to implicitly include the salt, and that's entitled to deference here, particularly in view of the recent Supreme Court Teva decision. Now, when it comes to the literal infringement issue, the district court likewise found that the Abacavir free base was not still in there in the salt, that it had been chemically modified in a way that took it outside the claims. Now, when plaintiffs say, oh, but somebody admitted that in vivo you can actually destroy the sulfate salt and get some Abacavir free base before it gets metabolized to carbavir triphosphate, that is fundamentally irrelevant, because these claims that are at issue here have more in them than just here is a Bacavir being used in a patient. What these claims require are all kinds of additional elements relating to being in a combination with either one other drug or two other drugs, being administered as a unit dose, etc. And the plaintiffs did not separately parse out their method claims this way. So when it comes to each and every element being infringed, when it comes to what's going on inside the body, they never tried to show each and every element of their claims was satisfied when you were in vivo. And that's a fundamental failure proof. They didn't even try to prove that at the district court. And sorry.
We'll conclude your argument. You're way over time. And here's Mr. O'Quinn for final statements. Just on the non-infringement issue, the subject of your cross-appeal, please.
Yes, Chief Judge Prost, thank you. First, Judge O'Malley, in answer to your question, the reason there's another lawsuit is they filed another ANDA with respect to a different drug, and this patent is asserted with respect to that drug.
Okay.
Now, turning to the issue of infringement, again, there are three independent reasons why Lupin's product infringes. The first is that the method claims, what my colleague was just talking about, the method claims, all of the elements are met when a patient is treated with Lupin's product. They're all literally met. However, the chemical formula term for Abacavir is construed, whether it's construed as just being the free base or it's construed as we think it should be as encompassing the salt forms as well. Either way, they're all construed. And my colleague made points about, well, there are other things that haven't been proved up. Respectfully, that's just not true with respect to method claims 30 and 39. If you look at method claims 30 and 39, They depend on independent claims 20 and 32. And what does it say? A method for the treatment or prevention of the symptoms of, or effects of an HIV infection in an infected animal, treating said animal with a therapeutically effective amount of a combination comprising Abacavir, and one of them is Abacavir and 3TC, and the other is Abacavir AVT and 3TC. And what all the claims 30 and 39 add to the independent claim is that said animal is a human. And you have other dependent claims that show it doesn't matter the sequence in which they're administered. So if you look at claims 27, 28, 29, 27 talks about simultaneous, 28 talks about sequential, 29 talks about a single combined formulation. But that is a subset of what's covered by independent claims 20 and its counterpart 32. And the only, as I said, the only thing that dependent claims 30 and 39 add, which are asserted here, is that it be a human. And there's no dispute about that. So there's no dispute that the drugs are all, that a person, a patient, a human, is treated with a back of your free base, and not as just some person testified, but their expert on non-infringement, Dr. Arnold, specifically testified, quote, about Lupin's product provides Abacavir. That is the active ingredient. Otherwise, it wouldn't work. And that leads me directly into the issue of infringement under the doctrine of equivalence. Because even if for some reason not to find that there's literal infringement of the method claims, this is clearly a case that falls within the doctrine of equivalence. And Dr. Langer, our expert, explained that Abacavir sulfate is used like Abacavir to treat HIV symptoms the same way, by delivering the same active ingredient, Abacavir, to inhibit HIV replication in the same way. That's at A351 to 356. That's the function way result test every time. And the only responses to that that were offered either by the district court or by Lupin are, well, you don't know that it necessarily has the same handling properties. That's not relevant to the claims that are asserted, and it's certainly not relevant to the asserted method claims. Or to suggest that there should be some per se rule against applying the doctrine of equivalence this way, because there are other claims that could have been asserted that might also cover these things as well.
Let me ask you about that. So why didn't you assert the claims that specifically reference the salt derivative?
Judge O'Malley, I'm not privy to that. I mean, trials about choices, about narrowing things down, and the parties narrowed a number of things and dropped defenses and dropped claims as well. And as the claims were being dropped, the claims that were asserted were the ones that were being asserted. Certainly,
you can understand the trial court's concern. So you've got a patent, and maybe the patent has five claims. You choose to assert one, and when you lose on infringement on that one, you say, well, under DOE, we can get what could have been asserted under Claim 3.
But Judge O'Malley, that concern would come up in every single case. I mean, that would create a prospect where a party would essentially run the risk, if you don't assert all of the claims in your patent, then you're going to lose scope of DOE that you would otherwise have. That is inconsistent with the Graver-Tank decision itself, and this court walked through that in Johnson & Johnson, where you had claims that would have been literally infringed, except it turns out those were invalidated. It's not just that they weren't asserted, they were invalidated. And later the Supreme Court held that the claims that remained, that were asserted, would capture that scope under the doctrine of equivalence. And this court has recognized in a number of cases, Multiform Desiccants, 133 F3rd at 1480, that, quote, claims that are written in different words may ultimately cover substantially the same subject matter. Claims are looked at, they rise and fall independently both for infringement purposes and for invalidity purposes. And so to go the way that the district court did would be to be making a policy choice. And that is exactly what the Supreme Court has reiterated in Warner Jenkins and Festo, that the courts are not supposed to be doing with respect to the doctrine of equivalence. And to come up with some sort of a per se rule here, I think would A, be inconsistent with that, and B, I think it would create bad incentives in district court and make it hard for parties to narrow the claims that are being asserted without running the risk of exactly what you were just talking about, Judge O'Malley. But in any event, we think this is also a straightforward case for literal infringement, precisely because there can't be any serious dispute that all three of the claimed elements are what a patient is treated with. I mean, it's right there on their own label. I mean, you ask why might you have narrowed some claims? I mean, you look at the label, A5782, in vivo abacavir sulfate disassociates to its free base abacavir. No dispute over that. And then finally, and the court certainly doesn't have to reach this in order to reverse with respect to the method claims, but we also have the argument that, in fact, the chemical formula term abacavir appearing in the claims would be construed as, by a person of ordinary skill in the art, as encompassing the salt forms as well. Just as this court held in Merck versus Teva. And the only argument that my colleague makes to the contrary is to say, well, there's testimony that a person of ordinary skill in the art understood these were different chemical formulas, that they're different chemicals, different chemical weights and so forth. That's not disputed, and it's also not relevant. And in fact, this court in Merck versus Teva specifically rejected that kind of argument, that kind of reasoning, saying the question is not whether a person of ordinary skill in the art would understand whether they're different chemicals. The question is whether they would understand in the context of the claims, the context that they're being that they're written, that by using it, you meant to encompass the active ingredient, however it was administered, whether in its free base or free acid or salt form. If the court has further questions, I'm happy to take those. Otherwise,
no. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We ask that the court
thank all counsel participating in the case.
Thank you.